Morning, everybody.
Hope you all enjoyed the keynote earlier today. It's now my great pleasure to introduce a colleague from National ICT Australia, Patrick Dabnowski, to talk about computers, programs and logic. What does Linux prove?
Hi. The talk I'm giving today is about hacking mathematics. I thought everybody's here a hacker, and I thought I'll give something different. So let's try to actually do some theorem proving, but with GCC. And I'll talk about it. I'll show you why it's cool, why you've all been doing it every day, probably. Assuming you write code. I also talk about, you know, cool things like Gödel's incompleteness theorem, holding problem, paradoxes, stuff like that. If you know much about the subject, you probably won't get all that much out of the talk. If you didn't, hopefully you'll leave the talk with a zen-like understanding of the topic and the formal logic. Well, if you don't, better have some Panadols because you're going to have a monster hangover to cure tomorrow, and I don't mean from the dinner tonight. Okay, let's start with some history. This is computer science in a nutshell. It basically started with two kind of trends. One was trying to automate calculation, and that started around 1800s with Babbage trying to come up with a more error-proof way of computing the logarithmic tables. Then towards the end of the century, this guy started IBM and discovered he actually can make money with it. And around the war time, the whole discipline got a big boost with trying to crack German Enigma, first in Poland and with Flowers, Turing student actually designing Colossus. And the rest of it, you probably know the names. Van Neumann came up with the idea of a stored program computer. Backus came up with Fortran. Ritchie came up with C. And then open source here. Well, there has been a separate trend in mathematics that actually led to very much the same result. And there has been very little cross-pollination between the two timelines. Unfortunately, until very recently when purely functional languages like Haskell, designed in 1988 by Simon Petrone and others, actually started to gain mainstream language and people write things like Perl compilers in it. Well, it all started with Aristotle, who came up with the notion of logic. And for 2,000 years, nobody actually did anything with it until, you know, around 1800s again, Boole came up with his Boolean arithmetic. Everybody thought he was on crack, and he was. towards the end of the century, Cantor came up with set theory, totally unrelated to the whole foundation, to the whole computer notion, but he was trying to formalize mathematics, and as it wasn't formal enough already. And Frege continued, tried to formalize arithmetic instead. Russell in 1901, before even Frege managed to publish his work, showed that it doesn't make sense. And Frege just dropped the whole thing. He was actually a philosopher, you know, so if it doesn't make sense, why bother with it? Well, Hilbert was back then a very young, enthusiastic guy who proposed this grand challenge for mathematics, Hilbert's problem, to axiomatize off all mathematics. Well, he proposed it in 1920, but in 1932, only 12 years later, Gödel showed that it cannot be done. And that was pretty much the first problem that ever been shown that cannot be done, rather than actually yes or no, but it cannot be done. We cannot know. And Gödel did it for arithmetics. His first incompleteness theorem was arithmetics. And not until Church came up with lambda calculus, on the same year, actually, that Gödel actually was given tools to actually do it for any problem, any kind of algorithm. Because what lambda calculus did, what Church actually did, is formalize the notion of a program or algorithm. So he actually invented the first programming language. He didn't even know that. He actually points out in his paper, oh, there might be well other uses for this stuff, but I cannot think of any. No. Wish he was alive today. In 1936, 4 years later, Turing came up with the same result, but he was actually coming from the mechanical translators trend, so he actually produced a hardware model for the same thing. So he produced the first assembler, basically, as a Turing machine. In 1958, Carey and Howard independently showed that those two actually are identical to logic to what Frege and Cantor were doing in Bull before. And that's mostly what I'll be trying to lead to during this talk. And then from then on, slowly but surely, people actually started applying it in everyday life. And I'll show you today how to actually apply it in your life using GC. Okay, so before I actually go into GC, I probably have to give you a bit of, you know, math. And I want to actually show you what formal logic actually looks like, because we all know there is a formal logic, you know, mathematicians somewhere in the universities do it, but what does it actually look like? And what I'll actually do is I'll show you Gensen's natural deduction system, because it's nice and clean. Frege did equivalent things earlier, but his theorem is kind of messy. Makes a book, other than one slide. Well, what Gensen came up with is those inference rules. And the first one is very simple. All the inference rules look like that. They have a line. Above lines are things that we are obliged to prove. And then we've got this weird thing that's called turnstile. And before it, in blue, we've got a thing that we've assumed. We are allowed to assume anything we want, but we have to actually keep track of what we've assumed. And at the end of that proof, there will be assuming these things. And in black is basically what we've actually the fact that we're actually dealing with. So say we've got this, and the gray thing is basically just the name of the rule. So the ideal rule is very simple. Assuming A, we can prove A. No other stuff needed. Makes sense, right? Well, two more interesting rules is implication introduction and implication elimination, also known as modus ponens. The arrow is implication, okay? So the II rule, the introduction rule, says that under some list of assumptions, called gamma, it's just a list of assumptions, we can prove A implies B. So if A, then B. If, look above the line, given the same assumptions plus another assumption A, we can from that infer B. Make sense? If we assume A and that allows us to actually work out B, then we know that if and then B. And the cool thing is we actually get rid of the assumption A in that way. That's the only way in this system to actually get rid of an assumption, actually make it non-assumption, but actually part of the proof. Then once you actually create an implication for the arrow thing, so an if statement, if you like, how do we actually get rid of it? Well, if we know that A implies B, and we also know that A, then what do we know? We know B, right? Because A implies B. That's basically what's said, and we also have to, you know, combine the assumptions we've made in the process. And in natural deduction, there's about six other rules. I'll only show you two of them. They're not really needed, but they make things easier for us and more correspond to natural language like English. So, for example, the disjunction, or, with to normal people, basically has two rules. If we actually, we can work out A or B if we know A, alternatively if we know B. So if we know something, we can always say this or something else, because the thing we know already, you know, allows us to make the whole thing true, regardless of whether B is true or not. Now, how do we get rid of it once we actually introduce it, or simple interval proof, how do we get rid of it? Well, we can get rid of it if we know not A. Or not one of, or alternatively not B, you know? If we know A or B, and one of those is false, then the other one has to be true, because the whole thing is true. Make sense? Well, there's similar ones for AND, but just to sort of make things easier, I didn't bother with them because we don't really need them in the rest of the talk. Now, that's what mathematicians and logicians actually been doing, and they were very proud of this because we can actually do a very nice proof of it. That's why the lines are actually written like they are. The way we do it, we write the thing we want to prove at the bottom, and we stack up the proof at the top until there's nothing about the line. Make sense? So basically, here I'm trying to prove that if we know A and B, A implies B, and then B implies C, then we know that A implies C. So basically, we want to prove transitivity of implication. Everybody with me so far? Cool. So how do we do it? And that's where proofs actually get annoyingly hard. We have to actually magically work out how to do it using our, you know, godlike intellect. I actually worked it out, and I cross-checked with Google to actually work out that I didn't make a mistake on the slide. And basically what you do is, some of these really simple proofs are actually really tricky. I'll actually show you how GC makes them easier to do, believe it or not. So basically we have to assume A and B first. Wait, it makes sense because we're going to have the assumption A and B in the thing we're proving anyway, right? So we might just as well assume it from the start. And from that we can, by the ID rule, work out A implies B. Similarly for B and C, and also let us assume A. We'll have to get rid of that assumption somehow. But for now, let us assume that. That's the crucial bit. Now, let's use I use MP for modus ponens. That's the same thing as implication elimination. So remember the rule which says that if we can assume A implies B, and we also know A, then we can assume B. Well, we use that. So, but we've got more assumptions that we want now, but we know now B. Then use modus ponens, so again, and now we know B and C and D, right? So under those assumptions, we know C using modus ponens. But hang on, now we can use the implication introduction to move the A from the assumption list back into the left-hand side, into the actual proof. And we've got what we've proven, so we've proven it. The cool thing about this proof is they're purely syntactic. You can write a program to check them. Checking proof is really easy. It's actually linear. So there's no difficulty. You can write one in 10 minutes. I've done it heaps of times. Creating proof is hard. And in fact, Godel showed it's not possible in general using algorithms. So we cannot write a program to write a proof for us, any proof you want. We can write some, but not all. But we can always check, once we actually have a proof, we can check whether it's right or not. Now, this is all good, but logicians are actually wary. It all looks really nice and cozy, but is the system consistent? By consistent, I mean, does natural deduction only allow us to infer things that are in fact true? Can we create a proof using this stacking thing that actually is false, prove something false, like, you know, Bill Gates can write code, kind of thing. Well, say we can prove A, and we can also prove not A. Say we've got a system like that, dot, 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 somewhere. Then, by disjunction introduction, we can prove that either A or Microsoft is good. Hang on, but by disjunction elimination, we know that A or B is good and not A means that Microsoft is good. We cannot have that, can we? So basically, the moral of the story, if a system is inconsistent, if it allows us to prove something and not something. Well, now the question is, does natural deduction allow us to do it? And for 2,200 years, everybody thought, no, it does not allow us to do it. And then Russell came up with Russell's paradox. And what does Russell's paradox? Remember, natural deduction actually corresponds directly to, you know, English statements, like, you know, if this, then that, and stuff. So he created a statement. He wrote it in nice symbols, but I'm actually going to write it in text. Makes perfect sense to everybody in this room, I'm sure. Microsoft writes code for all people who cannot write it for themselves. And it doesn't write to anybody else because, you know, they would use Linux if they can write code. Make sense? Sounds reasonable. Hang on. So does Microsoft write, use its own code or not? It only uses its own code if it cannot write it. And vice versa, it cannot write its code if it actually uses it, so the code doesn't exist. Well, okay, so this is all funny and everything. The original paradox was formulated as a set of all sets that do not contain themselves. So does it contain itself or not? Because he was actually challenging Cantor's set theory. But it basically applies to just about every logic that has been designed that far. Well, let us consider another thing, also with Windows, because I just couldn't resist. If this sentence is true, this is actually known as Carrick's paradox. It's a version of Russell's paradox. If this sentence is true, then Windows doesn't crash. Well, let's call the whole thing A, just so we can actually go quickly into back into symbols, right? And let's call this bit B. Okay? So the whole thing basically looks that A, the whole thing is equivalent to A, this sentence implies B. Puzzled? There's this circularity of it, which is basically what creates the paradoxes. Same as Microsoft and itself. You know, all the paradoxes have like things like this sentence or itself in it, the circularity. So basically, this particular sentence is equivalent to this particular sentence implies B. You could actually, you know, unnest loop it. Anyway, let's see what we can prove, if we can prove this statement in natural deduction. Well, we start, as always, with an identity. And then what we do is, so we assume A, and we can move the assumption using into the arrow. Then what we can do is substitute the red A for the right-hand side of the green equation at the top, because they're identical. They mean to be the same thing, so we can do it. So we do that. But hang on, we've just proven, remember this thing, if A, then B, and B, then C, then A is C. Actually, we didn't prove that quite, but we got very close in two more lines, and we'll get that. Hope everybody can see how we can do that. So basically, from that, we know A implies B. But hang on, what we can do with that is we can substitute back A from the green equation for A implies B, because they're equal. So from that we get A. Make sense? What we've done here is A implies B is equivalent to A. So once we've actually proven A implies B, we can just say A. And then we repeat that again. The whole thing except for the last line. And now, by modus ponens again, we know A implies B, and we know A, so we know B, so we know Windows doesn't crash. And that doesn't make sense. So the moral of the story is natural deduction, natural classical logic, as is actually inconsistent. And that's not good, because logic is meant to be foundational mathematics. Bad logic means bad mathematics. As remember, if we can prove something that's false, then we can prove anything at all, including, you know, Windows is good. And there have been, when Russell pointed this out to Frege, Frank basically very hastily wrote an appendix to his book. And he acknowledged it was a big problem, but he actually did not, he came up with this solution using types, and it was very clumsy. And as we all know, types can get in a way. They're just like, you know, programming types, C types. They get in a way, and every now and then they just want to use a cast. Same thing with it. It's really clumsy. What he actually didn't realize is by introducing types, he actually restricted what you can prove in this logic. Not, you cannot, you might not be able to prove false, but you also cannot prove important things as well that you wanted to prove. He didn't realize that. Russell actually came up with a different notion, verification theorem, and he basically also didn't realize it was, he was restricting his system unreasonably. But we now use versions of both. But to actually, you know, look at what these things are, we need to formalize the notion of actually the stacking things up that we've just done. Because so far we've just done it pictorially, you know, stack things up. But what does it actually, the whole stacking mean? Like, how do you actually, you know, formalize it? So that's what I'm going to do next. And you, by now you're probably all asking, what does that have to do with the price of fish? Well, now, don't worry, I'm getting there. We're getting very, there's only one more slide before we stay with GCC and C code on the screen. Well, what does it have to do with the price of fish? Is church. Oh, not this church, this church. Okay, this guy basically came up with lambda calculus. What he was trying to do is formalize the notion of an algorithm. And he managed to do it very nicely. That's what it looks like. That's what constructs algorithms. That's all. Well, people are giving me blank stares by now, so let me quickly cross it out and ask you, let's just say that Church invented C. Slightly different notation, but it's effectively the same thing. Just different notation. So basically, what do we have in C? Well, we've got a lot of goo that makes us all, you know, warm and fuzzy inside, but at the end, it's actually just, you know, syntactic sugar. If we start stripping things that we don't need from C, like we can actually create using other things, we'll end up with three things. We'll end up with variables. We cannot strip those. We'll end up with function calls. So we're given an expression E1, an expression E2 in parentheses, we just call, do a function call, you know, normal C notation. And we also need a way of creating functions. And unfortunately for us, C is actually, the notation for creating functions is kind of cumbersome to put on this slide. So what I did, I used the traditional C without function types. You know, all the types are automatically int. So basically, I just dropped the type. So we need to give every C function a name, call it fun for this one. And we put the parameters in X. Usually, we'll put the type in front of it, and a return type in front of the whole thing. And then in calibrated, we put an expression that it returns. OK. Now, you're asking, how on earth could that possibly do everything we want? How could you write Linux with just these three things? Well, you probably wouldn't want to, but you can. And I'm just going to show you a very simple thing. How can you create Booleans, if statements, in C, without actually mentioning if statements anywhere in your program, just functions. Just functions, function calls. Not even like ints, nothing. Here it is. In lambda calculus, when you're trying to create things like Booleans or integers, like defined integers, basically you only have functions to work with. You've got, so basically a true and false have to be function. And they will tend to actually capture the essence of what that particular object means. So for true and false, basically the function's taking two arguments and true returns the first one and false returns the second. So you probably see that basically the two actually are kind of a choice between the first and second argument. And that's what Booleans are used for. The special thing about Booleans is the if statement. They're used in the if statement. Everything else, you know, is also used with integers and stuff. And, you know, big strings, for example. Now, so look at what the if would look like. Forget the not and, and or for now. Well, if is a function that takes three things. The condition, P, the then branch called A, and the B branch called B, and the else branch, right? It's an if, then, else. And what it will do? Well, it will just take the condition P, which has this B built-in choice into it. It's a function that returns either the first argument second, and pass it the A as the first argument, which will be written by true, and the second argument, which will be written by false. Can you see it? It's really tricky. It's also cute, I think. You can actually do the same thing with integers, but you need instant recursion, so I think it would probably take about 2 slides to do it. And you can do it with while loops, everything. You can actually define all of C just using those three things. Function call, variables, and the function definition. Now, and, well, what is and like? You know, ampersand in C. It goes like, if the first argument is true, then return the second one. Otherwise, return the false. Make sense? So basically, that's what it looks like. It returns P, which is this choice thing, and returns Q, if it's true, if P was true. And if it's false, just returns false. Or it's similar, except flipped. Not was a bit awkward to define. I cheated a little bit. I cheated in two ways. First of all, I used a GC extension and define a nested function. You don't really need to, but it would just be a little bit awkward because you have to malloc it and stuff. If we actually have enough time at the end of the talk, I'll actually go to slide that does it without any sort of extension in MCC. That checks everything. And what not does is basically just create a function that flips the arguments. So if it's true, it returns the other thing. If it's false, if the original thing was true, then returns a function that returns the false branch and the true branch otherwise. That's all it was. It returns a function because not P is a predicate. So it's also a function. Predicates are, you know, true or false. Try it in the C compiler. It will work. Not will probably crash because it actually returns a pointer to a function Q, which is on the function Q, which I just casted just to, you know, make the whole thing compile. It will probably crash if you use not because Q references P, which is on the stack of not. So once you actually return from not, P is no longer defined. Yep?
Could you not define not P as return P false true?
Yes, you could. Yes, you could. No, I know that. But you could because implication is just a... To explain that, I would have to probably define the disjunction as a unroll implication in terms of disjunction, which I didn't want to bother. Yes, you could. Definitely could. There's many ways of defining not, and in fact, it's actually quite possible to do all of classical logic without even mentioning not. So, and it's actually not that difficult because there's a not built into an implication. The arrow hidden in there. Well, as I said, if we get time at the end, I'll show you how to actually fix this little nuisance I did. Well, okay, I scrolled a little bit too fast. On the previous slide, you probably noticed what happens if we call an if with some other random function as p, function that actually isn't neither true or false. Well, we probably get a call dump. And that basically means you can actually define things in this language, in this subset of C, which will compile, but call dump. And we don't quite want that. So what do we do? Well, we invent types. And that's what everybody is using. Everybody knows that function prototypes are good, right? So let's actually put function prototypes in our language. So basically, we put a T1 and T2 in the right places. So basically, now foo is a function taking type X of type T2 and returning T1. And the syntax of T types, again, I've removed structures and unions. We could all put them if we wanted, but we don't bother. In my PhD, I actually do it. So there's two kinds of types. There's integers, chars, and all those. And there are functions taking T1 and T2. In C, the notation for the type of a function, it's a pointer to a function specifically, it's kind of awkward, so most people will do a type def, and now put is a function from T1 to T2. And in this talk, I'll actually, you know, think this, even this is awkward, so I'll just write T1 like arrow T2. Make sense? So that every time you see T1 to T2, imagine this sort of annoyingly defined C type that describes the pointer of a function. We'll write a parameter argument, one write return value. Okay, how do we make this up? Because we all know how to make programs. We've got the DNF grammar that I just shown to actually describe it, but how do we actually make types? Well, let's just say, how do we create something of type A? Well, the weird brackets are meant to represent things that are in scope. So this says that A, X is in scope and has type A. As it has been previously defined as a variable of type A. Make sense? So basically, in square brackets, we've got all the variables that have been defined in our program so far. So basically, that says if we've got a variable of type A, we can just quote that variable to get an object of type A, right? Now, how do we create functions? Well, that's our function. This function will have a type A, arrow B, A, white arrow B, right? So function from A to B. We don't care about the environment for this function because it's probably a global function, but there is a constraint on what foo can look like. The body of the function has to have type B in an environment in which X is defined to type X. Make sense? That's what I'm just saying here. And I put the arrows just because, you know, we got used to, you know, putting, you know, our propositions above our above the line and our propositions under the line and our sort of assumptions above. That's why I'm using the line. Now, also, how do we call a function? Because, well, if we have a function from A to B, a procedure from A to B, and we also have some X that we can actually give it as an argument, right, of type A, then we can actually call this function and get a B. It returns a B. Make sense? Now, do people notice things, interesting things about it? Blank stairs, how about if I remove those? Still blank stairs, how about if I add that? This is identical to the first three propositions of our natural deduction. The only difference between that, yeah, as you use weird brackets instead of tensile, and white arrow instead of black arrow. So basically, the difference between this, between our C-type system, our C-type, and natural deduction is just syntax. That's the only difference. It's just typography. We could write a text program that actually would actually change from one to the other. This is what's called by Karikawa's osmosis. It's probably the most significant result in computer science up after Turing solved the Hodding problem. And it's basically what is at the foundations of theorem proving. Now, types are just theorems. But what are these blue bits? Just putting back the blue bits that we put in there. How we construct the types. Well, the blue bit is what we use to construct the types, right? So our theorems. So they are kind of example witnesses for our theorems. Make sense? They're like examples, something that actually, you know, we make shows, oh, okay, like, give me a, show me A. Okay, I'll give you X. For example, things like that. You know, it's a example of that actually proves the theorem. It's an example of this type, so it's a proof by example, effectively. So basically, under Karikawa's osmosis, is theorems are types, and programs are proofs of these types. of this type. Here. And it goes really deep. It goes really, really deep. No matter what you actually do, because it's just so purely syntactic, these two things are really the same. That's why it's called isomorphism. They're not just similar, or they happen to be the same in this instance. They're always the same. So if you actually come up with something, some whiz-bang addition to your logic that makes whiz-bang things possible, you know, temporal logic or something, there will be a correspondence in programming languages and vice versa. If you come up with some beautiful programming construct, there's a correspondence in logic to it. And you can actually work out with these two. The cool thing is, I'll get to that later. So now let's actually try to prove a theorem, you know? GC, show me the corner, show me the proof. Okay, remember this proof we just did, let's just do it in GC. Let's use GC to prove this last line. Okay, so that's what we're trying to prove, right? We're trying to prove A implies C under assumptions, A implies B and B implies C. So we're trying to come up with an expression, C expression or C program that actually will type that, will actually happen to have this type. The moment it happens to have this type, we've actually got a proof. This is, what's the proof? Well, this, here you go. Now, there is a white cockatoo out there. Well, here's one. That's our proof. You know, that kind of thing. Well, equivalently, we just use the implication introduction twice, and we can change the proof to basically what we're trying to prove is fine. It's a function pool that takes two parameters, A implies the function from A to B and function from B to C, and returns function from B to A to C. Make sense? It's just the same thing. Rather than putting them in global variables like before, I just put them in function parameters. Yep. Okay. Well, I'll define the type depth for these functions, so we don't have to use the annoying C notation for functions. And so basically, we're looking for function pool that looks like that. So now we need to find proof. Okay. Well, proof is a function. We know it's proof has type A to C, right? Function from A to C. So it has to be function. So, well, it will look something like that. Function proof from A to C. What's the C though? Well, we don't have any C's here. We don't have nothing of type C. But we've got something from type A to B. And we've got something of A, right? So we can call function X with the argument that was given to proof. And we'll get B. And then we do the same from C, and then we can C, and we've got a proof. You run it through the C compiler, it compiles, means it touches, means you've proven theorem. Congratulations. That's what they're actually doing every day when you put in function prototypes. You're proving theorems about the problem. They tend to be very simple, admittedly, but they have less theorems, and you can actually make more important theorems by switching to something like C++, which actually has more elaborate type systems, so you can prove more things and so on and so forth. Okay, so Russell's paradox revisited. Let's see what a function of A to B that's actually equal to A would look like in C. Well, it would be something like, what does it return? Well, we don't have anything of type B in there, but we've got A, but we're looking for A to B. Hang on, we've got A to B already. It's called paradox. Okay, but now you'll notice, actually, that will not compile. The reason why it won't compile is because the type depth will be rejected, because it's recursive, and that's not allowed in C. So type systems actually save us from inconsistent theorems. Unfortunately, if we cross out the type depth, this will compile. If we put replace B with char and A with int, something like that, you know, it will compile. But it still be an instant recursion that will not run out of stack. In fact, you can actually prove just about anything, including do things like that, and it will not crash, it will just never terminate. So they might save us from inconsistent inference, but they do not save us from inconsistent proof. And that is, in a nutshell, Golov's incompleteness theorem. Basically, there's zillions of proofs of Golov's incompleteness theorem out there. But the original one, and I thought I'll just stay with the original one, it looks like that. Godel basically considered a statement. This statement is unprovable. You can put it, you cannot say this statement is false because that's an obvious paradox, but this is not a paradox yet. It's not an immediate paradox. Well, if it is unprovable, then the statement is true, right? So our theorem cannot prove some statement. Our logic cannot prove something. Make sense? Well, it can prove P, because P is true. But if it is provable, then P is false. So the logic contains a false statement. So it's inconsistent. So basically what Gödel showed is any system can actually is either incomplete or inconsistent, provided it can express its statements like that. So it can express reasoning about itself. And also that he's got infinite number of theorems. And this is where his ingenuity, that's why, you know, he is so famous, because he actually works out the nitty-gritty, which is the final bullet point. You actually need to be an infinite number of statements to actually do that. Because if we only had a finite amount of statements, you could actually put an axiom going, oh, this statement is forbidden, and we'd be fine. So we could just forbid all the, you know, bad statements, and it'd be fine, the theorem would be cool. But if we got infinite number of them, he actually showed that if we forbid this statement, this forbidding is actually an axiom which will generate another statement of this form. Yep. Okay. So what does Linux prove? We've got 1 minute, and that's about all we need. Well, Linux. Linux takes the user's hard typing, hard gameplay, hard everything, and before it returns, it takes more user input and more user input, and lots more user input. In fact, never returns. Well, but that's the whole point. You know, it's never crashes, it runs forever, right? So what does it mean? Well, it takes user input forever. It never stops, never crashes. So it's a paradox. You know, it's an infinite loop. It's a paradox. Like our paradox function. But it's useful. So we need paradoxical proofs. It's a proof. You don't need a proof. It's a program, it's a proof. To do useful things. And that's a public sensitivity. Okay, obviously it's sort of just intuition. But what the intuition I wanted to give you guys is that we all actually know that you need infinite loops. You need to be able to write infinite loops to do useful things, like Linux. So basically, if we want our system to be useful, we need to be able to express infinite recursion or infinite loop. And this is what Gödel's incompleteness theorem was about. That's all it is. It just says, to do useful stuff, you need this loop. And this loop is basically the paradox. So our theorem is inconsistent. If it's useful, it's inconsistent. Three pages if you're interested in this stuff. 12 is a tool that actually does allows you to do useful and very sophisticated theorem proving, like, for example, proving, you know, the whole program correct and stuff like that, using this whole proof as type correspondence. And there's a lot on the 12 pages, 12 tutorial, with a lot of useful information. It will be very heavy going at the beginning, but at the end, you actually will, if you can get through it, you'll do fine. You'll do fine in theorem proving, and you'll open yourself job opportunities in, you know, safety critical software. Mostly in Europe. Philip Wobler has beautiful slides, talks on this stuff from the history of history of computer science. He wants to talk about, you know, computer science as a scientific discipline, as a form of science, and not rather than engineering. And he goes into a lot of points that he talk about it, and these slides are really readable. I highly recommend going to this page and reading them if you're interested. And at the end of the day, search Wikipedia for natural deduction, Gödel's incompleteness theorem, you'll find a lot of interesting material in there. Oh, any questions?
Yeah, We have time for about one question. We have one.
Proof of the inconsistency of Jensen's logic. There's a step in there that doesn't seem to make any sense.
There's what there?
In your slide way back near the beginning.
Okay.